It's not just consumer spending that matters, gang. It's how we spend. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, 8 December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to go macro here at the top of the program today. Macro about you and me and how much we owe. The Federal Reserve reports that consumer credit, that's mainly credit cards and student loans and car loans, consumer credit rose $27 billion in the month of October. The annual rate of growth in consumer credit outstanding comes to 6.9%, again, annual rate. And that is, if you've been keeping track, faster than most people's incomes have been growing in this economy. Credit card balances alone growing quicker than they have in 20 years. Consumer spending is, of course, the lifeblood of this economy. I don't know how many times we've said it, but as we borrow to do that spending, maybe that's not so great. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Back in early 2021, at the height of the pandemic, many Americans were getting their debt under control. Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions explains why.
Everyone got their stimulus checks, and a lot of people used that to pay down some of their highest rate debt. So we had a big deleveraging.
Then the federal money stopped flowing. Prices started rising. And since then, consumers have been drawing down their savings, putting more purchases on credit cards and buy now, pay later plans.
To the point that we're now pretty much back to where we were on trend to be prior to the pandemic. I think this speaks to financial hardships with higher inflation.
And keep in mind, today's consumer debt carries a significantly higher cost to the borrower because of the Fed's interest rate hikes. Ted Rossman is with Bankrate.
These are the highest credit card rates we've ever seen, and we've been tracking this since 1985.
Higher balances plus higher interest rates dig a deeper hole for consumers.
There's a cumulative effect, and we're worried that next year we may have a recession, hopefully a mild one. We are expecting further upticks in delinquency.
There is an upside to rising consumer debt. Sam Stovall at CFRA Research points out it's a sign of strong consumer demand.
The more that consumers buy, the lower the likelihood that we are going to be falling into recession.
Stovall says higher debt and interest payments are also good for banks. Remember, they're a part of the economy too. But what's not so good?
If we do fall into recession, then these consumers who now have higher debt levels could have a hard time paying them off if they end up losing their jobs.
Fortunately for consumers, the retailers they're buying from, and the banks they're borrowing from, there's no sign unemployment is on the rise, at least not yet. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A little bit of a boost on Wall Street today after some sluggishness early in the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Campbell Soup Company said this week that sales, as measured in dollars, rose 15% last quarter over the same time a year ago. Sales volume, though, as measured in actual cans of soup and loaves of Pepperidge Farm bread and Milano cookies, they actually fell over the same period, down 1%, selling less product, yet bringing in more money. Marketplace's Justin Ho does the grocery essentials math for us.
Whenever John Stanton's walked down supermarket aisles this year, he says it's been hard to miss higher prices on packaged foods.
It's noticeable, and I walk through the supermarkets regularly.
Stanton does that because he's a professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University and a former consultant to the Campbell Soup Company. He says it's not just packaged foods that are getting more expensive.
It's buffered by the fact that not only are these packaged goods going up, but it seems like everything's going up.
Produce, meat, dairy, even going out to eat. Amy Bentley, a professor of food studies at NYU, just went out to a lunch spot to buy herself some hot soup.
And a small container was like $6. You know, at some point I'm thinking, can I really justify buying that container of soup for my lunch if it's way more than I'm comfortable spending?
And that's exactly the kind of thought that makes Campbell soups and other packaged goods look a lot more attractive.
Because it's seen as an economy food and shelf stable, and it's something that Americans have relied on for a long time.
People could trade down further and buy generic or private label foods, says Aaron Lash, an analyst at Morningstar. But
consumers that trade down are still paying a higher price than what they would have over the past year.
Food companies' input costs have been rising. Campbell says its costs were up 18% last quarter. Lash says packaged food companies are likely to keep prices high since their costs are likely to stay high.
Some of that tends to be more sticky, meaning that if you've put through wage increases, those are unlikely to be rolled back.
Next year, Lash expects packaged food companies to focus on offering multiple products at different price points so people have cheaper options. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Mitchell was talking a minute ago about how we're doing as consumers. The flip side of that, of course, is the people behind the register selling us stuff, especially relevant they are this time of year. So this week, we're hearing from some of those small retailers today via the Pacific Northwest.
My name is Kalina Bruce, and I am the owner of Nora Lux Candle Bar in Seattle, Washington. So Nora Lux started as kind of a pandemic passion project in my kitchen, actually. So I decided to kind of teach myself how to make candles. And that led into, hey, I think I want to have a side hustle. And that led into launching a whole e-commerce site, virtual candle making classes. And that got my wheels turning about what it might look like for me to have my own space. We just opened our brick and mortar in February, so this is our first holiday retail season at the Candle Bar. Things are going really well. This week, we're super booked with holiday parties, and then obviously, we also sell pre-made candles, and I think folks are starting to find us a little bit more, so that's been going well, too. I would say the biggest challenge was initially like the supply optimization piece. We have a lot of heavy things. And so like our wax is a 50-pound box of wax. Our vessels are glass or ceramic. So often shipping is like silly, really crazy. So we try to find local vendors as much as we can. And then when we can't, we try to order in bulk. We have about 5 part-time staff, and then I'm here full-time. Many of them are family, so my mom, my brother, my daughter. We're in the process of just trying to grow our team. Just because our time has been so limited, we haven't done like postings and stuff widely, but I'm really confident that we're going to be able to add 2 to 3 more people in the next few months. In the next couple of weeks, I hope that we see a lot of folks who come in and they're making candles, and then would love to see like candles being shipped out across the country. You know, like we have a little map of like places our candles have gone. So would love to like fill in those areas that, you know, we haven't been to yet.
That was Kalina Bruce making candles at Noir Lux up in Seattle. Coming up,
probably almost $2,000.
That whole always a bridesmaid, never a bride thing, it is expensive. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 183 points today, about 0.5%, 33,781. The NASDAQ grew 123 points, 1.1%, 11,082. The S&P 500 gained 29 points, 0.75%, 39.63. Mitchell was telling us about consumer credit. So let's look at some credit card stocks, shall we? Visa gained 0.6%. MasterCard lifted 1%. Discover down, though, 0.8%. Last month, a metric ton of lithium would set you back $69,470. That's according to Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, three times what it cost a year ago. Demand for lithium, a mineral key to the making of electric vehicle batteries and a lot of electronics, has become so high that some mining companies want to do away with the fixed price contracts that have been standard in that industry. That means they can adjust prices, of course, as demand ebbs and flows. So some lithium stocks, Lithium Americas, grew 1.5%. Li-Cycle Holdings, LI, simple for lithium, right? If I remember my periodic table, I don't know. They were unchanged. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. President Biden has said that he wants to get the American economy to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The amount of change that that's going to mean across all sorts of industries is big, perhaps none bigger than transportation, which is responsible for almost 30% of our greenhouse gas emissions. We are making some progress decarbonizing cars, yes. It is going to be way harder to get that done, though, with airplanes. A new report from the Rhodium Group says the best way to do that in the next couple of decades is with something called sustainable aviation fuels. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, it is not gonna be easy.
Planes are tricky to decarbonize, a lot trickier than trains and automobiles. Melissa Law at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy says the industry is still very much in the early stages.
We've figured out what types of options we have, whether it's electrifying planes, replacing their fuels, or offsetting emissions, but we've only just started actually using those solutions.
The most realistic and effective option in the short to medium term is replacing conventional jet fuel with something greener. Kristen Brandt at Washington State University says that basically means fuel made from some kind of waste.
You can use municipal solid waste, you can use forest residues, you can use agricultural residues, you can capture carbon from the air.
These fuels burn a lot cleaner, Brandt says, and they can just be dropped into existing planes. Magursa Abate at the World Bank says that's a big part of the appeal for airlines, which have spent billions of dollars buying planes.
Because you don't want to strand all these multi-billion assets that you have, right? So you want to continue using them. I mean, most of them have 20, 30 years lifespan.
And airlines can continue to use the planes they already own with these newer sustainable fuels. No big retrofits required. But one of the challenges, he says, is that sustainable aviation fuel is 3 to 5 times more expensive.
And in addition to that, its availability is very limited as well.
In most countries, he says, it's not available at all. And even in places where it is, like the U.S., there isn't that much being produced yet. So far, it makes up just 0.1% of all the airplane fuel currently being used. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
There is a slice of this economy that kinda hasn't missed a beat the past couple of years, pandemic and supply chain and inflation notwithstanding. High-end art is the topic at hand, and it's at hand because we're coming off a record auction season. So we've gotten Lisa Austin on the phone. She's an advisor in the world of fine art. Wanted to get a little context. Lisa, it's good to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give me a thumbnail sketch, would you, of the fine art market in this economy right now?
The fine art market for the last couple of years has been roaring. What we have seen, particularly with the high net worth individual, which is, you know, the core of the art market, mm-hmm. is that they've made more money this year and they have more money than ever before. So what we've had now is a really robust, almost irrationally exuberant market couple of years.
I chuckle because we all know what happened after Alan Greenspan yes. said things were irrationally exuberant. How long, right? I mean, how long yes. can this last in the art market?
I think till just now.
Oh, really?
That's what we're hearing. I mean, I looked at the auctions, and of course, the Paul Allen auction was mm-hmm. a blockbuster.
The guy who helped found Microsoft, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he's kind of a famous guy. He had a stellar collection, things that you very rarely see on the market. And so all of those wonderful, you know, that confluence of great events, you know, had it achieve $1.5 billion, which was the highest ever total for a single collection ever sold. So it was amazing. But that kind of sucked a little of the air out of the room. And the rest of the auctions were strong, but they weren't blockbusters. And so the rest of the auctions being the evening sales and the daytime sales for Christie's, Sotheby's, and Phillips, which are the big three.
Why does it seem that art prices never come down? They just keep going up? Or is that just me? I mean, look, I'm a peripheral observer of this market, but it does seem that you see records all the time and you never see things like, you know, prices have cratered in the fine art market.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a pretty controlled market.
Yeah.
So you may not see prices cratering, let's say, at the gallery level, but you might see negotiation go up. You might see the discounts get bigger. So at auction, you do see prices come down, which is one of the kind of the nerve-wracking elements of sending something to auction.
Yeah. I guess the moral of the story there is that rich people are looking for a bargain just like the rest of us, right?
Correct. No, they like it as much, yeah. if not more than yeah. anyone else.
You know, I was doing an interview on the runway shows, high fashion and mm-hmm. haute couture a number of years ago. And the woman I was interviewing, I said, you know, why does this matter to the regular person? And she said, look, what shows up on the runways, especially now in this era of fast fashion, shows up in H&M and Target and all the rest of them weeks or months later, and it all kind of trickles down. Is there a corollary here with the art market?
I really don't think so.
Yeah.
This is really a playground for the super wealthy. Even an entry-level artist might be $20,000 or $30,000, which we in the market now say, oh, that's great. That's a great piece. $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. That's a lot of money for an average person.
Yeah.
That's not the H&M buyer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't want to, you know, hazard a guess one way or the other about the next 6 to 8 months in this economy, but there are, you know, there are rumors and predictions and thoughts that maybe there's going to be an economic slowdown, perhaps even a recession. Mm-hmm. Does that do anything to the art market?
It will, even if it's just perception. Because what I'm hearing, you know, from dealers who were there and from some of the auction house representatives is that the froth, it seems to be gone. Sales are satisfying, but there is going to be more opportunity to get access to certain artists maybe that you couldn't get before. But from what I'm hearing and seeing from everyone, they all feel like it's moving into a more subdued kind of market.
Lisa Austin, she's an advisor on fine arts. Lisa, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kai.
$28,000. That's in dollars, and it's the average cost of a wedding in this economy. That's according to the wedding site The Knot. Obviously, yes, weddings are expensive for the people getting married, or maybe more accurately, the people paying, but they can be costly if you're just going to one, too, and especially so if you're in the bridal party, because there's a good chance you're going to be spending money on that tailored outfit you're only going to wear once, or on a plane ticket for a bachelor party across the country. And the thing is that when you mix money and friends, it can get, you know, messy. That brings us to our podcast, This is Uncomfortable. Host Rima Kreis has a story that started on a vision board and ended in court.
When Zinzile Sibanda's best friend got engaged, Zinzile landed the honor of being named her chief bridesmaid.
I would say like, oh, I feel like I'm getting married too. Like, I was so happy for her.
And her best friend, who for this story we're going to call Sophia, had a very specific vision.
I think with her vision, what maybe mattered more was probably how she looked, how her bridesmaids looked, and in the pictures.
Together, Zinzile and Sophia came up with a picture-perfect plan. The bridesmaids would wear the same intricately planned outfits, from the dresses all the way down to their hairstyles. And all that, on top of the bridal events, was going to come with a hefty price tag. And so how much money in total do you think you spent as a bridesmaid?
Probably almost $2,000.
And this actually isn't as outlandish as it might sound. The average bridesmaid in the U.S. ends up spending about $1,200 on a friend's wedding. Zinzile had recently gotten laid off, so money was tight, though she figured she could make it work. But then, an unexpected twist. Leading up to the wedding, she got diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and the medication she was prescribed came with intense side effects.
Like, my hair was a big one. I had this patch of no hair in the middle of my head. It looked terrible.
After weeks of agonizing, Zinzile decided her only option was to chop off her hair. But when Sophia found out, she asked Zinzile, hey, do you think you could hold off until after the wedding? She wanted all the bridesmaids to have the same exact hairstyles, which to Zinzile was unreasonable.
I did feel a little bit upset at her, like, you're not getting it.
Zinzile worried that the wedding hairstyles, the updos, the braids, would only further damage her hair. But with the wedding just a few days away, Sophia didn't understand why Zinzile couldn't just wait a little to get a haircut. They went back and forth, but neither would budge. And then things escalated. Sophia sent Zinzile this text message.
After our recent conversations, I'd like to remind you of my boundaries. I've been very accommodating and graceful, but I can't allow
Sophia went on to remind Zinzile of all the intense planning that had gone into this wedding and how upset she was with Zinzile for tainting her vision, a vision that Zinzile helped her plan. It concluded with this.
Solution. Since this is something you can no longer commit to fully, I need you to please step down from participating in my wedding.
Oh my God. What was your first reaction?
Oh, I was so angry.
2 days before the wedding, she'd been kicked out of the bridal party. And now she was left with a pile of useless and expensive wedding clothes.
It was $808.94.
That was money that could have gone towards groceries or rent. She was furious. She decided to invoice Sophia for the expenses, but was met with radio silence. And so this is when Zinzile took things up a notch. She filed a case in her county's small claims court. For those of you who haven't sued a friend before, small claims court is a relatively quick, inexpensive way of resolving IOUs, usually when the amount is less than around $10,000. Generally, in these cases, you represent yourself. So in the lead up to the hearing, Zinzile scrambled to compile her evidence.
What you need to prove is that you kind of kept in contract.
I see. Of like being a bridesmaid, essentially.
Of being a bridesmaid, essentially.
The hearing would be on Zoom, and when the day finally rolled around, Zinzile was the first to make her case to the judge. She had several exhibits.
So first off was the receipts for everything. The second exhibit was a picture of the dresses and shoes. Exhibit three was the messages. Exhibit four was pictures showing my hair loss.
She was thorough. Sophia didn't want to be interviewed for this story, but essentially her argument was that Zinzile had broken her promise and was being intentionally difficult. They were then told to wait at least 90 days for a verdict. And then one afternoon, Zinzile got an email.
I'm reading and then I'm like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh.
Zinzile had won. And were you expecting to win?
No. No. I was like, the courts are going to look at this and be like, yeah, it kind of is a stupid case.
They're going to be like, neither of y'all win.
Yeah, weddings, exactly. Because to me, I was like, this is giving Judge Judy. Not like an actual court. This is giving the cases on Judge Judy.
Yeah. Still, as grateful as Zinzile is for the sense of justice and for the check, she misses their friendship. And while wedding drama is sometimes inevitable, she wishes it hadn't put their friendship on trial. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I know I've been hitting oil and gas hard lately, but they are kind of a big deal, seeing as how they're oil and gas, right? Anyway, there is a guy we talk to every now and then. His name is Tom Kloza. He founded something called the Oil Price Information Service. So he's been at the oil and gas price thing for a long time. I'm just going to read you his tweet from this morning. For the first time in 654 days, he said, U.S. consumers are paying less for gasoline than they did 1 year ago. The average of $3.329 a gallon. That includes 26 states with prices cheaper than last year. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Another key commodity whose prices are way, way down, lumber. As priced on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, random length framing futures, that's the official category, random length framing futures, are down around $413 per 1,000 board feet right about now. That is off the pandemic peak, which was more than $1,700 per 1,000 board feet. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Cardine, the Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.